Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller, featuring Smitten Kitchen. We're going to start off today with the recipe for the perfect blueberry muffin loaf. It's been about, what has it been, I don't know, 8 years since I overhauled an old blueberry muffin recipe in the archives to turn them into what I consider the highest calling of the category. Perfect in taste, not too sweet, dreamy crumb, lemon-scented, absolutely riddled with blueberries, and finished with the crunchiest bronze lid. Perfect for lifting off in a satisfying shell and swiping the underside with salted butter. And ease, one bowl, hand-whisked, even with measurements, or even measurements, fuss-free ingredients. Because who cares if a muffin recipe is perfect if I can't throw it together half asleep like the zombie I am most mornings? I am so thrilled that so many of you agree. And while I know that hundreds of us each year turn them into blueberry muffin loaf cake simply by pouring the batter into a loaf pan and baking it, I've done it too, and it's time to admit that I'm never satisfied with the outcome, because the loaf was underfilled and deprived of the muffin top dome on top that is everything to me. I mistakenly thought it might need a simple math equation to adjust, 1.5 times, and as usual, it was more complicated. 1.6 times the butter, 1.3 times the yogurt, 2 times the eggs. And now every surface of my kitchen is covered with rejected muffin loaf tests, but it was worth it because this is perfect, and I don't think I will ever rifle through the cabinets looking for paper liners again. This is everything a perfect blueberry muffin should be in one giant, craggy, crunchy loaf with real take-me-with-you energy. It's ready for picnics, friends, tea, brunch, bake sales, teacher and librarian appreciation weeks. Also, for 90 minutes from now, it's because we've waited long enough, because that's all it takes. So here's the recipe, perfect blueberry muffin loaf, serves 8 to 10, takes 90 minutes, and the source is Smitten Kitchen. Note, very key here is the size of your loaf pan, because this will fill out every speck of it before it's done. Mine holds 6 liquid cups, or 1420 milliliters. It's 8 by 4 inches on the bottom and 9 by 5 inches on the top. If yours is even slightly smaller or you're nervous, go ahead and scoop out a little to make a muffin or two on the side. When making this for the first time, place a sheet pan underneath just in case it spills over. But I can promise you that in several tests, mine never has. You'll need 8 tablespoons of unsalted butter, cold is fine, 3/4 cups of granulated sugar, finely grated zest from 1 lemon, 1 cup of plain unsweetened Greek-style yogurt, 2 large eggs, 2 teaspoons of baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda, 3/4 teaspoon of kosher salt, 2 cups of all-purpose flour, 2 1/4 cups of fresh or frozen blueberries, no need to defrost, 3 tablespoons of turbinado sugar, which is also known as sugar in the raw. You're going to heat your oven to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Line a loaf pan with 1 big piece of parchment paper pressed into the corners and up the sides. I leave the excess paper extended over the rim, which also helps protect you against overflow. You're going to melt the butter in a large bowl and then whisk in the granulated sugar and zest. Add yogurt and eggs and whisk to evenly combine. Sprinkle the surface of batter with baking powder, baking soda, and salt, and whisk thoroughly into the batter several times more around the bowl than is necessary for it to look mixed. Add the flour and berries and use a flexible spatula or spoon to mix them in so that no pockets of flour remain. Batter will be very, very thick. Spoon into a prepared loaf pan and drop it on the counter a few times to make sure that there are no air pockets. Smooth the top and sprinkle it with turbinado sugar. It will seem like way too much, but I beg you not to skimp at all. The batter is not very sweet, but the crunchy top that the sugar provides is one of the best parts. You're going to bake it for 60 to 70 minutes until a skewer inserted into a few places in the loaf come out batter-free. If your berries were frozen going in, this might even need 5 additional minutes. Remove from the oven and let cool in the pan and use parchment paper to lift it out of the pan and cut into thick slices. As far as doing ahead, I use the parchment paper to transfer leftovers back to the loaf pan. Store at the room temperature for 3 to 4 days or longer in the fridge. I keep the loaf uncovered or unwrapped, which helps the top to retain its crunch. The sides are kept from drying out by the parchment and loaf. The loaf freezes well if it's wrapped tightly. And P.S. Yes, of course you can use any other kind of berry here. I tested a few rounds with frozen mixed berry mixes, and as long as the strawberries aren't comically huge, I used chopped ones when I did it, then it works great. Next, we've got a recipe for black bean and vegetable bake. This looks absolutely scrumptious. As far as a letter of recommendation, make a deep skillet of your favorite taco or burrito filling, cover it with cheese, and broil the whole lot of it in the oven. Then scoop it up with tortilla chips. I hope you're not asking why, because I know you heard the part about the lightly charred and gooey cheese on top. Did I mention that you get to eat chips for dinner, which, to be fair, you can do anytime you want, I mean adulthood, but this actually involves a lot of vegetables. Adulthood excellence. Did I mention that kids are 200% more likely to eat a pan of beans and vegetables when it's covered with cheese and comes with a bowl of chips? Because, let's be honest, this was a motivator. Just as it was in 2017 when I encouraged us to bake large beans as if they were ziti and scoop it onto garlic bread. I want my kids to eat more beans and lentils so that I get to eat more beans and lentils, but they're resistant. In the last couple of years, I've doubled down, cooking lentils as if they were French onion soup, chickpeas as if they were brisket, and black beans as if they were queso fundido, as often as I can get away with it. It's essentially a large pan of my favorite bean burrito filling, and it's highly flexible. Use the beans you're craving and the vegetables you have. Add meat if you'd like it, and more heat, especially if you're not cooking for my offspring. So here we go. Here's the recipe, black bean and vegetable bake. This serves 8. Takes 45 to 50 minutes, and the source is Smitten Kitchen. Note, this makes a lot. We end up eating it for at least 2 days, and when we run out of chips, we end up scooping it into our small flour tortillas, closing the taco to dip to the taco loop, as you would say. You could make half the dish in a 2-quart baking dish or 8-inch round oven-proof skillet. Or you can make all of it and freeze half before melting the cheese on top and baking the rest right now. Future you is pretty glad that you thought about it. For this recipe, you'll need 2 tablespoons of olive or vegetable oil, 1 large onion, diced small, 4 cloves of garlic, minced, 1 fresh jalapeno or habanero pepper, minced, 1 bell pepper, diced, 1 teaspoon of ground cumin, 2 to 3 teaspoons of ground chili powder to taste, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1 28-ounce can of tomatoes or 2 to 3 cans of Rotel, kosher salt, 2 15.5-ounce cans of black beans drained and rinsed, 1 cup of corn kernels fresh from 1 ear, canned and drained or frozen, there's no need to thaw. 4 ounces of baby spinach, roughly chopped, 1 lime halved, 3/4 cups of crumbled cotija cheese, 6 to 8 ounces, that's 1.5 to 2 cups of coarsely grated Monterey Jack or pepper jack cheese, and tortilla chips. Heat your largest oven-proof skillet or saute pan over medium-high heat. And once hot, add oil, and once the oil is hot, add the onion, garlic, jalapeno, and bell pepper, and cook until the ingredients begin to soften, 4 to 5 minutes. Add the cumin, first 2 teaspoons of chili powder, and tomato paste, and cook for 1 minute. Add diced tomatoes and let simmer for 1 minute, then add the beans and simmer for 2 to 3 minutes. Taste the mixture and add salt. I find I need between 2 to 3 teaspoons of kosher salt, that's Diamond brand, to get the level right, but just adjust it to your taste. Add the last 1 teaspoon of chili powder if needed for your desired heat level. Add the corn and spinach and stir until the spinach has wilted and everything is warm. Taste for seasoning again and adjust as needed, and squeeze juice of half a lime over it. Meanwhile, heat your oven's broiler, and if it doesn't have a broiler, heat it as hot as your oven goes. If your skillet isn't oven-proof, then you can pour the mixture into a baking dish and mix the jack and cotija cheeses and sprinkle the mixture over the beans. A smaller amount of jack cheese covers the pan less thickly than shown here and allows more sauce to bubble through. The larger amount is never unwelcome, however. Transfer to a broiler and cook until the cheese is melted and browned on top. Eat right away with tortilla chips and hot sauce of your choice. And if you're me, a squeeze of juice from the second half of the lime. You could also do lemon, but lime is probably better. As far as doing ahead, while the whole dish reheats well in a 350-degree oven, if you're planning to eat it later, I'd wait to put the cheese on until right before you serve it, because cheese is at its most stretchy, gooey, you know, the first time that it melts. Next, we're going to have a recipe for the easiest French fries. Last weekend, we had 13 friends over for moules frites. This, plus a big green salad and some crusty baguettes and more white wine than seems conscionable, is my favorite dinner party menu. It makes the easiest, surprisingly budget-conscious meal, and might, if you play your cards right, make you feel ever so slightly like you're on vacation somewhere European and full of sailor types. Okay, maybe that's pushing things, but let's run with it. Oh, I forgot to add, however, that it's best for 6 people or 8 at the most. As soon as the mussels exceed the volume of your largest pot or the fries surpass the one large tray that fits in your oven, plus you have a salad you really only want to toss at the last minute. Basically everything needed to be cooked a la minute, you are going to have to hustle. I am constitutively incapable of hustling, so we ate dinner at 10 p.m. I usually make my oven fries, but I decided that for a crowd it would be easier to let a fryer do the work. And I borrowed one from a friend who's married to another friend who's obsessed with fried chicken. I mean, I'm sure it's just coincidence. I prepped 7 pounds of potatoes the day before, but as I stuck them in the freezer overnight, I realized that this was going to be a lot for each person. It would only allot about 16 fries per person. So look, I know we all like to believe that we eat only 16 fries when we go out, and then that's totally fine. But I think we can all agree that we're going to be happiest if a person who makes your fries knows better and cooks accordingly. So I went back to the store for another 7 pounds of potatoes, and as I peeled and soaked and dried and fried and drained to only these to fry again later, I began to understand why restaurants have a dedicated fry cook. I decided to make these with a less complex twice-fried method, and I did a quick search for the best starting temperature, and you can tune back in now. I promise the point is nigh. I landed on a 2009 Cook's Illustrated recipe that boasted no peeling, no soaking, no deep fry thermometer or deep fryer needed, and that used 1/3 of the oil that the deep fryer required. Also meaning that you can buy better stuff without going broke, and that claim to absorb less. This is the cooking equivalent of searching to the ends of the earth for the dress that you're looking for, only to settle for a non-returnable second choice before finding it. You'd think I'd never want to see another French fry again after last weekend, but only if you don't know me and my tireless devotion to fried potatoes better. Plus, how could I not want to find out? I was reminded as I was prepping these for my friend Valerie, who would sometimes make really excellent fries for our lucky kids at playdates, and I would pester in the kitchen. Do you soak them to get rid of extra starch? You fry them twice at different temperatures, right? And she looked at me like I had two heads and said, no, I just fry them. As it turns out, both Valerie and Cooks Illustrated were onto something, which is that if you use slightly waxier potatoes known as Yukon Golds or yellow potatoes, which are far more delicious if you ask me anyway, you can put them right into a pot of cold oil that barely covers them and cook them over high heat for about 25 minutes, almost completely hands off, and drain off of the most golden crisp, glittering with fine sea salt heap of French fried happiness. And then, if you're in it for the science, you can measure the oil that you have left over and discover that they've absorbed all of 4 tablespoons, which will absolutely lead to French fries in your life more often. Guys, I am just here to help. Here's the recipe for the easiest French fries. This serves 4 generously. Time, it takes 45 minutes with prep. And the source is Cook's Illustrated. This recipe requires no peeling, no soaking, no twice frying, no deep fry thermometer or a deep fryer, no temperature monitoring or even stirring, and uses a fraction of the oil of the classically twice fried frites. It really, really loves us. A few changes from the original. CI has you bevel your potatoes into perfect batons and isn't clear what to do with the edges. I use them all. Thinner pieces will cook faster and darker, and I will generally fight you for them. As far as oil choices, any neutral oil that can handle high frying temperatures will work. My favorite for French fries is peanut. You can add 1/4 cup of duck, goose, or bacon fat for an even more delicious flavor. As far as salt, always salt your fries when they are hot, hot, hot from the oil. The finer the salt, the better it sticks. You'll need 2.5 pounds of Yukon Gold potatoes. That's about 6 medium. You'll need 6 cups of peanut oil, 1.4 liters, and fine sea or table salt. Cover your largest baking sheet with paper towels or paper bags for draining. Scrub the potatoes and dab them dry, then cut into 1/4 inch batons. Place in a 4 to 5 quart heavy deep frying pan or a Dutch oven and add oil. It will barely cover the potatoes. Turn the burner to high and bring the oil to a boil, which will take about 5 minutes. Cook the potatoes for another 15 minutes. Do not stir, they'll just break. At this 20-minute mark, you can use tongs or a thin spatula to gently scrape any loose potatoes that have stuck to the pan and continue to cook, stirring only if absolutely necessary, for 5 to 10 minutes longer, or until crisp and as golden as you like them. Use a large slotted spoon or spider to scoop potatoes from and spread them on a prepared tray drain, tossing immediately with salt as you do. You can keep the fries warm in a 200 degree oven, but the texture is really best right from the fryer. Next, to go with these fries, this is a particularly unhealthy but very yummy session tonight. We're going to have a recipe for a toasted marshmallow milkshake. You can't beat that. Almost exactly 5 years ago, in celebration of us both signing contracts to write cookbooks, I met a friend for lunch at a burger joint called The Stand on East 12th Street, and we finished the meal with something the menu declared a toasted marshmallow milkshake. I don't remember a thing about the burger, but I do know that pretty much every conversation I had in the weeks that followed went like this. Well, the weather is so nice today. It'd be perfect for a toasted marshmallow milkshake, don't you think? How is your son sleeping these days? Did I tell you about this toasted marshmallow milkshake I had? Let me tell you about this toasted marshmallow milkshake I had. Can you believe this Deepwater Horizon mess? Toasted marshmallow milkshake. Toasted marshmallow milkshake. You could argue it had some kind of impact on me. I don't know what happened after that, but I didn't get much sleep that year. Maybe I was busy writing a book. Maybe I was scared. I couldn't be trusted around a blender full of toasted marshmallow milkshake. All I know is that I failed you. I failed to pave the milkshake's path from 12th Street to your blender. And now, as we approach ice cream season again, it's time to make things right. What I thought was an obsession that existed only among people who'd eaten at the stand before it closed a couple years after has proven viral, and I found innumerable recipes for toasted marshmallow milkshakes on the web, including one that Gourmet had tracked down from the stand itself. But get this, it doesn't actually have any toasted marshmallows inside, only one on top. And in the glass beneath, it is more or less just a vanilla shake. I had suspected this at the time, but I didn't want to believe it, because no, this will not do. The flavor of toasted marshmallows, I like mine blackened and drooping off the stick, by the way, is everything. It's a burnt sugar whiff of vanilla coating a stretchy white cloud. It's summer and time spent outside and crackly campfires. And I know this is getting really, I don't know, but I don't care. I just want to stuff everything awesome about them into a frosty glass and slurp it through a straw. I hope you join me. Here's the recipe. Toasted marshmallow milkshake. Oof, this shake. I'm going to have to add burnt marshmallows to my official list of third trimester cravings, I fear. This is essentially a vanilla ice cream shake blended with the better part of a bag of charred marshmallows, plus two flavors I found that enhance the whole mess nicely: a scrape of vanilla bean seeds, though extract will work just fine, and a spoonful or two of sour cream, plain yogurt, or creme fraiche, the tang of which will help round out the sugar-spun cloud of sweetness. I was highly tempted to make two variations on this shake: a s'more shake, use chocolate ice cream and a swirl of chocolate fudge sauce and crumbled graham crackers on top, and then a strawberry and toasted marshmallow shake. Hull and slice 1/2 pound of strawberries and macerate for 20 minutes with 1 tablespoon of sugar and 1 tablespoon lemon juice, and then blend before adding milk and toasted marshmallows. But ended up being too obsessed with honing in on the vanilla marshmallow flavor to add any distractions. Do let us know if you try either variation or one of your own invention in the comments. The yield is just shy of 3 shakes in the 12-ounce glasses shown. You can have 4 to 5 shakes in the 8-ounce glasses that we found to be a better portion size later. For this, you're going to need 1 10-ounce bag of large marshmallows divided, 1/2 cup of milk, seeds scraped from 1/2 of a small vanilla bean or 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 2 cups of vanilla ice cream, 2 tablespoons of sour cream, plain yogurt or creme fraiche, 1/4 cup of heavy cream beaten to soft peaks with 1 teaspoon of powdered sugar for a whipped cream garnish. This is optional. You're going to place your glasses in the freezer and then heat your broiler. Line a baking sheet with foil and coat it lightly with a nonstick spray. Set aside the number of marshmallows you'll want for garnishes and estimate 1 to 2 per shake. Then spread the rest on the tray. Broil, keeping a close watch as the marshmallows will take on color very quickly for 1 to 2 minutes until they're the color you like. Don't be afraid of a little char, it really enhances the shake. Cool the tray in the freezer for 5 minutes until the marshmallows are no longer warm, and then transfer the broiled marshmallows to your blender. Blend with milk until as pureed as you can get them, and then pause to individually toast marshmallows for garnish over a gas flame or back under your broiler for a moment. This ensures that they're warm when they hit the glass. You're going to add your vanilla bean extract, ice cream, and the sour cream to the marshmallow mix in the blender, and then blend it until it's thick and smooth. Pour into chilled glasses and finish with a dollop of whipped cream if you're using, and a warm marshmallow. Slurp through the straw, repeat again very soon. Next, we're going to have a very quick recipe for the perfect Manhattan. Good way to end today. I've always been a little suspicious of the stories that surround old recipes. They often read too orchestrated. The pie was dropped on the floor and voila, a tarte tatin was born, etc. These don't ring authentic to me. The Manhattan cocktail is no different. One disputed theory holds that the drink originated at the Manhattan Club in New York City in the 1870s, where it was created for a banquet that involved everyone from Winston Churchill's mom to a failed presidential candidate that was so successful, everyone wanted the drink too. Another, also disputed, argues that it was invented by a bartender named Black in the 1860s. I'm far more enchanted to have read about a North Frisian island, some named Four, where the Manhattan cocktail is said to be popular. Apparently many people there immigrated to Manhattan and back again at one point, taking the drink with them, mostly because they apparently made it just the way we like it, a little dry. Is it true? As my research has been inconclusive, as soon as I hit publish on this post, I'm going to get on the boat and find out. This makes one drink. You'll need ice, 2 ounces of rye or bourbon whiskey, 1/2 ounce of sweet vermouth, usually red, 1/2 ounce of dry vermouth, usually white, 2 dashes of Angostura, Peychaud's or orange bitters, maraschino cherry, this is traditional, or a small piece of lemon peel for garnish. Add rye, vermouth, and bitters to a cocktail shaker with ice and stir, if you want to be uber traditional about it, or shake them together. Strain ice as you pour into a rocks or martini glass, or pour the ice and drink into a tumbler. Garnish and enjoy slowly, because this is bonkers potent. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff, read by Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.